Then, in a murky corner of the abandoned shrine, they saw the remnants of what might have been 4 small fires, ancient ashes, scorch marks on stone, or perhaps 4 funeral pyres. And in the centre of each of the 4, a small, blackened, fire-eaten heap of uncrushed bones. How the Buddha left the Sundarbans. The forest of illusions unleashed upon them, as they fled from temple towards boat, its last and most terrifying trick. They had barely reached the boat when it came towards them. At first, a rumble in the far distance, then a roar which could penetrate even mud-deafened ears. They had untied the boat and leapt wildly into it when the wave came. And now they were at the mercy of the waters, which could have crushed them effortlessly against Sundri or Mangrove or Nipper. But instead, the tidal wave bore them down turbulent brown channels as the forest of their torment blurred past them like a great green wall. It seemed as if the jungle, having tired of its playthings, were ejecting them unceremoniously from its territory. Waterborne, impelled forwards and still forwards by the unimaginable power of the wave, they bobbed pitifully amongst fallen branches and the sloughed-off skins of water snakes, until finally they were hurled from the boat as the ebbing wave broke it against a tree stump. They were left, sitting in a drowned rice paddy as the wave receded, in water up to their waists, but alive. Born out of the heart of the jungle of dreams, into which I had fled in the hope of peace and found both less and more, and back once more in the world of armies and dates. When they emerged from the jungle, it was October 1971, and I am bound to admit, but in my opinion, the fact only reinforces my wonder at the time-shifting sorcery of the forest, that there was no tidal wave recorded that month, although over a year previously, floods had indeed devastated the region. In the aftermath of the Sundarbans, my old life was waiting to reclaim me. I should have known. No escape from past acquaintance. What you were is forever who you are. For 7 months during the course of the year 1971, 3 soldiers and their tracker vanished off the face of the war. In October, however, when the rains ended and the guerrilla units of the Mukti Bahini began terrorizing Pakistani military outposts, when Mukti Bahini snipers picked off soldiers and petty officials alike, our quartet emerged from invisibility and, having little option, attempted to rejoin the main body of the occupying West Wing forces. Later, when questioned, the Buddha would always explain his disappearance with the help of a garbled story about being lost in a jungle amid trees whose roots grabbed at you like snakes. It was perhaps fortunate for him that he was never formally interrogated by officers in the army of which he was a member. Ayuba Balok, Farooq Rashid and Shahid Dar were not subjected to such interrogations either. But in their case, this was because they failed to stay alive long enough for any questions to be asked. In an entirely deserted village of thatched huts, with dung-plastered mud walls, in an abandoned community from which even the chickens had fled, Ayuba, Shahid, Farooq bemoaned their fate. Rendered deaf by the poisonous mud of the rainforest, a disability which had begun to upset them a good deal now that the taunting voices of the jungle were no longer hanging in the air, they wailed their several wails, all talking at once, none hearing the other. The Buddha, however, was obliged to listen to them all. To Ayuba, who stood facing a corner inside a naked room, his hair enmeshed in a spider's web, crying, my ears, like bees buzzing inside. To Farooq, who petulantly shouted, whose fault anyway? Who, with his nose that could sniff out any bloody thing? Who said, that way and that way. And who will believe about jungles and temples and transparent serpents? What a story, Allah Buddha, we should shoot you here and now. While Shahid softly, I'm hungry. Out once more in the real world, they were forgetting the lessons of the jungle. And Ayuba, my arm! Allah, man, my withered arm!
The ghost leaking fluid.
And Shahid.
Deserters, they'll say. Empty-handed. No prisoner, after so many months. Allah, a court-martial, maybe. What do you think, Buddha?
And Farouk.
You bastard. See what you've made us do? Oh, God, too much. Our uniforms. See, our uniforms, Buddha, rags and tatters, like a beggar boy's. Think of what the brigadier and that Najmuddin. On my mother's head, I swear. I didn't. I'm not a coward. Not.
And Shahid, who is killing ants and licking them off his palm.
How to rejoin anyway? Who knows where they are, or if? And haven't we seen and heard how Mukti Bahini, Thai Thai, they shoot from their hiding holes, and you're dead. Dead like an ant.
But Farouk is also talking.
And not just the uniforms, man. The hair. Is this military haircut? This so long falling over ears like worms? This woman's hair? Allah, they'll kill us dead up against the wall and Thai Thai. You see if they don't.
But now, Ayuba the tank is calming down. Ayuba holding his face in his hand. Ayuba saying softly to himself,
Oh man, oh man. I came to fight those damn vegetarian Hindus, man. And here is something too different, man. Something too bad.
It is somewhere in November. They have been making their way slowly north, north. North, past fluttering newspapers in curious, curlicued script, through empty fields and abandoned settlements, occasionally passing a crone with a bundle on a stick over her shoulder, or a group of eight-year-olds with shifty starvation in their eyes and the threat of knives in their pockets, hearing how the Mukti Bahini are moving invisibly through the smoking land, how bullets come buzzing like bees from nowhere, and now... A breaking point has been reached, and Farouk,
if it wasn't for you, Buddha, Allah, you freak with your blue eyes of a foreigner, oh God, yeah, how you stink!
We all stink. Shahid, who is crushing, with tatter-booted heel, a scorpion on the dirty floor of the abandoned hut. Farouk, searching absurdly for a knife with which to cut his hair. Ayuba, leaning his head against a corner of the hut while a spider walks along the crown. And the Buddha, too. The Buddha, who stinks to heaven, clutches in his right hand a tarnished silver spittoon and is trying to recall his name and can summon up only nicknames, snot-nose, stained face, baldy, sniffer, piece of the moon. He sat cross-legged amid the wailing storm of his companion's fear, forcing himself to remember, but no, it would not come. And at last, the Buddha, hurling spittoon against earthen floor, exclaimed to stone-deaf ears, It's not, not fair! In the midst of the rubble of war, I discovered fair and unfair. Unfairness smelled like onions. The sharpness of its perfume brought tears to my eyes. Seized by the bitter aroma of injustice, I remembered how Jamila Singer had leaned over a hospital bed. Whose? What name? How military gongs and pips were also present. How my sister... No, not my sister. How she had said, Brother, I have to go away to sing in service of the country. The army will look after you now. For me, they will look after you so, so well. She was veiled. Behind white and gold brocade, I smelled her traitorous's smile. Through soft veiling fabric she planted on my brow the kiss of her revenge, and then she, who always wrought a dreadful revenge upon those who loved her best, left me to the tender mercies of pips and gongs. And after Jamila's treachery, I remembered the long-ago ostracism I suffered at the hands of Evie Burns, and exiles and picnic tricks, and all the vast mountain of unreasonable occurrences plaguing my life. And now... I lamented cucumber nose, stained face, bandy legs, horn temples, monk's tonsure, finger loss, one bad ear, and the numbing, braining spittoon. I wept copiously now, but still my name eluded me, and I repeated, Not fair, not fair, not fair. And surprisingly, Ayuba, the tank, moved away from his corner. Ayuba, perhaps recalling his own breakdown in the Sundarbans, squatted down in front of me and wrapped his one good arm around my neck. I accepted his comfortings. I cried into his shirt. But then there was a bee buzzing towards us while he squatted with his back to the glassless window of the hut. Something came whining through the overheated air while he said, "Hey, Buddha, come on, Buddha, hey, hey." And while other bees, the bees of deafness, buzzed in his ears, something stung him in the neck. He made a popping noise deep in his throat and fell forwards on top of me. The sniper's bullet, which killed Ayuba Balok, would, but for his presence, have speared me through the head. In dying, he saved my life. Forgetting past humiliations, putting aside fair and unfair, and what can't be cured must be endured, I crawled out from under the corpse of Ayuba the tank, while Farouk, "Oh God, oh God, oh," and Shahid, "Allah, I don't even know if my gun will," and Farouk again, "Oh God, oh God, who knows where the bastard is?" But Shahid, like soldiers in films, is flat against the wall beside the window. In these positions, I on the floor, Farouk crouched in a corner, Shahid pressed against dung plaster, we waited helplessly to see what would transpire. There was no second shot. Perhaps the sniper, not knowing the size of the force hidden inside the mud-walled hut, had simply shot and run. The three of us remained inside the hut for a night and a day, until the body of Ayuba Balok began to demand attention. Before we left, we found pickaxes and buried him. And afterwards, when the Indian army did come, there was no Ayuba Balok to greet them with his theories of the superiority of meat over vegetables. No Ayuba went into action yelling, "Kadang, kablam, kapow!" Perhaps it was just as well. And sometime in December, the three of us, riding on stolen bicycles, arrived at a field from which the city of Dhaka could be seen against the horizon, a field in which grew crops so strange, with so nauseous an aroma, that we found ourselves incapable of remaining on our bicycles. Dismounting before we fell off, we entered the terrible field. There was a scavenging peasant moving about, whistling as he worked, with an outsized gunny sack on his back. The whitened knuckles of the hand which gripped the sack revealed his determined frame of mind. The whistling, which was piercing but tuneful, showed that he was keeping his spirits up. The whistle echoed around the field, bouncing off fallen helmets, resounding hollowly from the barrels of mud-blocked rifles, sinking without trace into the fallen boots of the strange, strange crops, whose smell, like the smell of unfairness, was capable of bringing tears to the Buddha's eyes. The crops were dead, having been hit by some unknown blight, and most of them, but not all, wore the uniforms of the West Pakistani Army. Apart from the whistling, the only noises to be heard were the sounds of objects dropping into the peasant's treasure sack. Leather belts, watches, gold tooth fillings, spectacle frames, tiffin carriers, water flasks, boots. The peasant saw them and came running towards them, smiling ingratiatingly, talking rapidly in a wheedling voice that only the Buddha was obliged to hear. Farouk and Shahid stared glassily at the field while the peasant began his explanations. "Plenty shooting! Thai, thai!" He made a pistol with his right hand. He was speaking bad, stilted Hindi. "Ho, sirs! India has come, my sirs! Ho, yes, ho, yes!" And all over the field, the crops were leaking nourishing bone marrow into the soil while he, "No shoot I, my sirs, ho ho, I have news, ho, such news, India comes. Jesso is fall, my sirs, in 1-4 days, Dhaka also, yes, no?" The Buddha listened. The Buddha's eyes looked beyond the peasant to the field. "Such a things, my sir, India. They have one mighty soldier fellow. He can kill 6 persons at one time. Break necks, creak, creak. Between his knees, my sirs, knees. His right words?" He tapped his own. "I see, my sirs, with these eyes, oh yes. He fights not with guns, not swords, with knees. And 6 necks go creak, creak. Oh God." Shahid was vomiting in the field. Farouk Rashid had wandered to the far edge and stood staring into a copse of mango trees.
"In 1-2 weeks is over, the war, my sirs. Everybody come back. Just now all gone, but I not, my sirs. Soldiers come looking for Bahini and killed many, many. Also, my son. Oh, yes, sirs. Oh, yes, indeed."
The Buddha's eyes had become clouded and dull. In the distance, he could hear the crump of heavy artillery. Columns of smoke trailed up into the colourless December sky. The strange crops lay still, unruffled by the breeze.
"I stay, my sirs, here. I know names of birds and plants. Oh, yes, I am Deshmukh by name, vendor of notions by trade. I sell many so fine thing. You want? Medicine for constipation? Damn good. Oh, yes, I have. What you want? Glowing in the dark? I also have. And book? Oh, yes, a joke trick. Truly, I was famous in Dhaka before. Oh, yes, most truly. No shoot."
The vendor of notions chattered on, offering for sale item after item, such as a magical belt, which would enable the wearer to speak Hindi.
"I'm wearing now, my sir. Speak damn good. Yes, no? Many India soldier are by. They talk so many different tongues. The belt is godsend from God."
And then he noticed what the Buddha held in his hand.
"Oh, sir, absolute master thing. It's silver, it's precious stone. You give." "I give radio camera, almost working order, my sir. It's damn good deals, my friend. For one spittoon only, it's damn fine. Oh, yes, my sir. Life must go on. Trade must go on, my sir. Not true?"
"Tell me more," the Buddha said, "about the soldier with the knees." But now, once again, a bee buzzes in the distance at the far end of the field. Somebody drops to his knees. Somebody's forehead touches the ground as if in prayer. And in the field, one of the crops, which had been alive enough to shoot, also becomes very still. Shaheed Dar is shouting a name.
"Farouk! Farouk, man!"
But Farouk refuses to reply. Afterwards, when the Buddha reminisced about the war to his uncle Mustafa, he recounted how he had stumbled across the field of leaking bone marrow towards his fallen companion, and how, long before he reached Farouk's praying corpse, he was brought up short by the field's greatest secret. There was a small pyramid in the middle of the field. Ants were crawling over it, but it was not an anthill. The pyramid had 6 feet and 3 heads and, in between, a jumbled area composed of bits of torso, scraps of uniforms, lengths of intestine, and glimpses of shattered bones. The pyramid was still alive. One of its 3 heads had a blind left eye, the legacy of a childhood argument. Another had hair that was thickly plastered down with hair oil. The 3rd head was the oddest. It had deep hollows where the temple should have been, hollows that could have been made by a gynecologist's forceps, which had held it too tightly at birth. It was this 3rd head which spoke to the Buddha.
"Hello, man," it said. "What the hell are you here for?"
Shaheed Dar saw the pyramid of enemy soldiers apparently conversing with the Buddha. Shaheed, suddenly seized by an irrational energy, flung himself upon me and pushed me to the ground with,
"Who are you? Spy? Traitor? What? Why do they know who you..."
While Deshmukh, the vendor of notions, flapped pitifully around us.
"Oh, sirs! Enough fighting has been already. Be normal now, my sirs. I beg! Oh, God!"
Even if Shaheed had been able to hear me, I could not then have told him what I later became convinced was the truth, that the purpose of that entire war had been to reunite me with an old life, to bring me back together with my old friends. Sam Manekshaw was marching on Dhaka to meet his old friend the Tiger, and the modes of connection lingered on, because on the field of leaking bone marrow I heard about the exploits of knees and was greeted by a dying pyramid of heads, and in Dhaka I was to meet Parvati the witch. When Shaheed calmed down and got off me, the pyramid was no longer capable of speech. Later that afternoon, we resumed our journey towards the capital. Deshmukh, the vendor of notions, called cheerfully after us.
"Oh, sirs! Oh, my poor sirs! Who knows when a man will die? Who, my sirs, knows why?"
Sam and the Tiger. Sometimes mountains must move before old comrades can be reunited. On December 15, 1971, in the capital of the newly liberated state of Bangladesh, Tiger Niazi surrendered to his old chum Sam Manekshaw, while I, in my turn, surrendered to the embraces of a girl with eyes like saucers, a ponytail like a long, shiny black rope, and lips which had not, at that time, acquired what was to become their characteristic pout. These reunions were not achieved easily, and as a gesture of respect for all who made them possible, I shall pause briefly in my narrative to set out the whys and the wherefores. Let me then be perfectly explicit. If Yahya Khan and Z.A. Bhutto had not colluded in the matter of the coup of March 25th, I would not have been flown to Dhaka in civilian dress, nor, in all likelihood, would General Tiger Niazi have been in the city that December. To continue, the Indian intervention in the Bangladesh dispute was also the result of the interaction of great forces. Perhaps if 10 million had not walked across the frontiers into India, obliging the Delhi government to spend $200 million a month on refugee camps, the entire war of 1965, whose secret purpose had been the annihilation of my family, had cost them only $70 million. Indian soldiers led by General Sam would never have crossed the frontiers in the opposite direction. But India came for other reasons too, as I was to learn from the communist magicians who lived in the shadow of the Delhi Friday Mosque. The Delhi Sarkar had been highly concerned by the declining influence of Mujib's Awami League and the growing popularity of the revolutionary Mukti Bahini. Sam and the Tiger met in Dhaka to prevent the Bahini from gaining power. So if it were not for the Mukti Bahini, Parvati the Witch might never have accompanied the Indian troops on their campaign of liberation. But even that is not a full explanation. A third reason for Indian intervention was the fear that the disturbances in Bangladesh would, if they were not quickly curtailed, spread across the frontiers into West Bengal. So Sam and the Tiger, and also Parvati and I, owe our meeting, at least in part, to the more turbulent elements in West Bengali politics. The Tiger's defeat was only the beginning of a campaign against the left in Calcutta and its environs. At any rate, India came, and for the speed of her coming, because in a mere 3 weeks, Pakistan had lost half her navy, a third of her army, a quarter of her air force, and finally, after the Tiger surrendered, more than half her population. Thanks must be given to the Mukti Bahini once more, because, perhaps naively, failing to understand that the Indian advance was as much a tactical manoeuvre against them as a battle against the occupying West Wing forces, the Bahini advised General Manekshaw on Pakistani troop movements, on the Tiger's strengths and weaknesses. Thanks, too, to Mr. Chamin Lai, who refused, despite Bhutto's entreaties, to give Pakistan any material aid in the war. Denied Chinese arms, Pakistan fought with American guns, American tanks and aircraft. The President of the United States alone in the entire world was resolved to tilt towards Pakistan. While Henry A. Kissinger argued the cause of Yahya Khan, the same Yahya was secretly arranging the President's famous state visit to China. There were, therefore, great forces working against my reunion with Parvati and Sam's with the Tiger. But despite the tilting President, it was all over in 3 short weeks. On the night of December 14th, Shaheed Dar and the Buddha circled the fringes of the invested city of Dhaka. But the Buddha's nose, you will not have forgotten, was capable of sniffing out more than most. Following his nose, which could smell safety and danger, they found a way through the Indian lines and entered the city under cover of night. While they moved stealthily through streets in which nobody except a few starving beggars could be seen, the Tiger was swearing to fight to the last man. But the next day he surrendered instead. What is not known? Whether the last man was grateful to be spared or peeved at missing his chance of entering the camphor garden. And so I returned to that city in which, in those last hours before reunions, Shaheed and I saw many things which were not true, which were not possible, because our boys, would not, could not have behaved so badly. We saw men in spectacles with heads like eggs being shot in side streets. We saw the intelligentsia of the city being massacred by the hundred. But it was not true because it could not have been true. The tiger was a decent chap, after all, and our javans were worth 10 babus. We moved through the impossible hallucination of the night, hiding in doorways while fires blossomed like flowers, reminding me of the way the brass monkey used to set fire to shoes to attract a little attention. There were slit throats being buried in unmarked graves, and Shahid began his,
"No, but what a thing! Allah, you can't believe your eyes! No, not true! How can it, Buddha, tell? What's got into my eyes?"
And at last the Buddha spoke, knowing Shahid could not hear. "O Shahida," he said, revealing the depths of his fastidiousness, "a person must sometimes choose what he will see and what he will not. Look away. Look away from there now." But Shahid was staring at a maidan in which lady doctors were being bayoneted before they were raped, and raped again before they were shot. Above them and behind them, the cool white minaret of a mosque stared blindly down upon the scene. As though talking to himself, the Buddha said, "It is time to think about saving our skins. God knows why we came back." The Buddha entered the doorway of a deserted house, a broken peeling shell of an edifice which had once housed a tea shop, a bicycle repair shop, a whorehouse, and a tiny landing on which a notary public must once have sat, because there was the low desk on which he had left behind a pair of half-rimmed spectacles. There were the abandoned seals and stamps which had once enabled him to be more than an old nobody. Stamps and seals which had made him an arbiter of what was true and what was not. The notary public was absent, so I could not ask him to verify what was happening. I could not give a deposition under oath. But lying on the mat behind his desk was a loose-flowing garment, like a jalaba, and without waiting any longer, I removed my uniform, including the she-dog badge of the Katya units, and became anonymous, a deserter, in a city whose language I could not speak. Shahid Dar, however, remained in the street. In the first light of morning, he watched soldiers scurrying away from what had not been done, and then the grenade came. I, the Buddha, was still inside the empty house, but Shahid was unprotected by walls. Who can say why, how, who? But the grenade was certainly thrown. In that last instant of his unbisected life, Shahid was suddenly seized by an irresistible urge to look up. Afterwards, in the muezzin's roost, he told the Buddha,
"So strange, Allah, the pomegranate in my head, just like that, bigger and brighter than ever before, you know, Buddha, like a light bulb. Allah, what could I do? I looked."
And yes, it was there, hanging above his head. The grenade of his dreams, hanging just above his head, falling, falling, exploding at waist level, blowing his legs away to some other part of the city. When I reached him, Shahid was conscious, despite bisection, and pointed up.
"Take me up there, Buddha. I want...
So I carried what was now only half a boy, and therefore reasonably light, up narrow spiral stairs to the heights of that cool white minaret, where Shahid babbled of light bulbs, while red ants and black ants fought over a dead cockroach, battling away along the trowel furrows in the crudely laid concrete floor. Down below, amid charred houses, broken glass and smoke haze, ant-like people were emerging, preparing for peace. The ants, however, ignored the ant-like and fought on. And the Buddha? He stood still, gazing milkily down and around, having placed himself between the top half of Shahid and Eerie's one piece of furniture, a low table on which stood a gramophone connected to a loudspeaker, the Buddha protecting his halved companion from the disillusioning sight of this mechanized muezzin, whose call to prayer would always be scratched in the same places, extracted from the folds of his shapeless robe a glinting object, and turned his milky gaze upon the silver spittoon. Lost in contemplation, he was taken by surprise when the screams began, and looked up to see an abandoned cockroach. Blood had been seeping along trowel furrows. Ants, following this dark, viscous trail, had arrived at the source of the leakage, and Shahid expressed his fury at becoming the victim of not one, but two wars. Coming to the rescue, feet dancing on ants, the Buddha bumped his elbow against a switch. The loudspeaker system was activated, and afterwards people would never forget how a mosque had screamed out the terrible agony of war. After a few moments, silence. Shahid's head slumped forward, and the Buddha, fearing discovery, put away his spittoon and descended into the city as the Indian army arrived, leaving Shahid, who no longer minded, to assist at the peacemaking banquet of the ants. I went into the early morning streets to welcome General Sam. In the minaret, I had gazed milkily at my spittoon, but the Buddha's mind had not been empty. It contained three words, which Shahid's top half had also kept repeating, until the ants, the same three which, once reeking of onions, had made me weep on the shoulder of Ayuba Balok, until the bee buzzing. "It's not fair," the Buddha thought, and then, like a child, over and over, "It's not fair," and again and again. Shahid, fulfilling his father's dearest wish, had finally earned his name. But the Buddha could still not remember his own. How the Buddha regained his name. Once, long ago, on another Independence Day, the world had been saffron and green. This morning the colours were green, red and gold. And in the cities, cries of Jai Bangla and voices of women singing Our Golden Bengal, maddening their hearts with delight. In the centre of the city, on the podium of his defeat, General Tiger Niazi awaited General Manekshaw. Biographical details. Sam was a Parsi. He came from Bombay. Bombayites were in for happy times that day, and amid green and red and gold, the Buddha in his shapeless, anonymous garment was jostled by crowds. And then India came. India, with Sam at her head. Was it General Sam's idea, or even Indra's? Eschewing these fruitless questions, I record only that the Indian advance into Dhaka was much more than a mere military parade. As befits a triumph, it was garlanded with sideshows. A special IAF troop transport had flown to Dhaka, carrying 101 of the finest entertainers and conjurers India could provide. From the famous magician's ghetto in Delhi they came, many of them dressed for the occasion in the evocative uniforms of the Indian Fauj, so that many Dakans got the idea that the Indians' victory had been inevitable from the start, because even their uniformed javans were sorcerers of the highest order. The conjurers and other artistes marched beside the troops, entertaining the crowds. There were acrobats forming human pyramids on moving carts drawn by white bullocks. There were extraordinary female contortionists who could swallow their legs up to their knees. There were jugglers who operated outside the laws of gravity so that they could draw oohs and ahs from the delighted crowd as they juggled with toy grenades, keeping 420 in the air at a time. There were card tricksters who could pull the Queen of Chirias, the monarch of birds, the empress of clubs, out of women's ears. There was the great dancer, Anakali, whose name meant pomegranate bud, doing leaps, twists, pirouettes on a donkey card, while a giant piece of silver nose jewellery jingled on her right nostril. There was Master Vikram, the sitarist, whose sitar was capable of responding to and exaggerating the faintest emotions in the hearts of his audience, so that once, it was said, he had played before an audience so bad-tempered and had so greatly enhanced their foul humour that if his tabla player hadn't made him stop his raga in midstream, the power of his music would have had them all knifing each other and smashing up the auditorium. Today, Master Vikram's music raised the celebratory goodwill of the people to fever pitch. It maddened, let us say, their hearts with delight. And there was Picture Singh himself, a 7-foot giant who weighed 240 pounds and was known as the most charming man in the world because of his unsurpassable skills as a snake charmer. Not even the legendary Turbiwallahs of Bengal could exceed his talents. He strode through the happily shrieking crowds, twined from head to foot with deadly cobras, mambas and crates, all with their poison sacks intact. Picture Singh, who would be the last in the line of men who have been willing to become my fathers, and immediately behind him came Parvati the Witch. Parvati the Witch entertained the crowds with the help of a large wicker basket with a lid. Happy volunteers entered the basket, and Parvati made them disappear so completely that they could not return until she wished them to. Parvati, to whom midnight had given the true gifts of sorcery, had placed them at the service of her humble illusionist's trade, so that she was asked, "But how do you pull it off?" and, "Come on, pretty missy, tell the trick, why not?" Parvati, smiling, beaming, rolling a magic basket, came towards me with the liberating troops. The Indian army marched into town, its heroes following the magicians. Among them, I learned afterwards, was that colossus of the war, the rat-faced major with the lethal knees. But now there were still more illusionists, because the surviving prestidigitators of the city came out of hiding and began a wonderful contest, seeking to outdo anything and everything the visiting magicians had to offer. And the pain of the city was washed and soothed in the great glad outpouring of their magic. Then Parvati the Witch saw me and gave me back my name. "Salim, oh my God, Salim, you, Salim Sinai, is it you, Salim?" The Buddha jerks, puppet fashion, crowd eyes staring, Parvati pushing towards him. "Listen, it must be you." She is gripping his elbow, saucer eyes searching milky blue. "My God, that nose! I'm not being rude, but of course, look, it's me, Parvati. Oh, Salim, don't be stupid now. Come on, come on." "That's it," the Buddha says. "Salim, that was it." "Oh, God, too much excitement," she cries. "Hare Bab, Salim, you remember? The children, yeah? Oh, this is too good. So why are you looking so serious when I feel like to hug you to pieces? So many years, I only saw you inside here." She taps her forehead. "And now you're here, with a face like a fish. Hey, Salim, come on. Say one hello at least." On December 15th, 1971, Tiger Niazi surrendered to Sam Manekshaw. The Tiger and 93,000 Pakistani troops became prisoners of war. I, meanwhile, became the willing captive of the Indian magicians, because Parvati dragged me into the procession with, "Now that I've found you, I'm not letting you go." That night, Sam and the Tiger drank chotapegs and reminisced about the old days in the British Army.
"I say, Tiger," Sam Manekshaw said, "you behaved jolly decently by surrendering."
And the Tiger,
"Sam, you fought one hell of a war."
A tiny cloud passes across the face of General Sam.
"Listen, old sport, I hear such damn awful lies. Slaughters, old boy, mass graves, special units called Khatyar or some damn thing, developed for purposes of rooting out opposition. No truth in it, I suppose."
And the Tiger,
"Canine unit for tracking and intelligence activities. Never heard of it. Must have been misled, old man. Some damn bad intelligence wallers on both sides. No, ridiculous, damn ridiculous, if you don't mind me saying."
"Thought as much," says General Sam. I say, bloody fine to see you, Tiger, you old devil!
And the Tiger?
Been years, eh, Sam? Too damn long.
While old friends sang Auld Lang Syne in officers' messes, I made my escape from Bangladesh, from my Pakistani years. I'll get you out, Poverty said after I explained. You want it secret, secret? I nodded. Secret, secret. Elsewhere in the city, 93,000 soldiers were preparing to be carted off to POW camps. But Poverty the Witch made me climb into a wicker basket with a close-fitting lid. Sam Manickshaw was obliged to place his old friend, the Tiger, under protective custody. But Poverty the Witch assured me, "This way they'll never catch." Behind an army barracks where the magicians were awaiting their transport back to Delhi, Picture Singh, the most charming man in the world, stood guard when, that evening, I climbed into the basket of invisibility. We loitered casually, smoking biris, waiting until there were no soldiers in sight, while Picture Singh told me about his name. 20 years ago, an Eastman Kodak photographer had taken his portrait, which, wreathed in smiles and snakes, afterwards appeared on half the Kodak advertisements and in-store displays in India. Ever since when, the snake charmer had adopted his present cognomen.
"What do you think, Captain?" he bellowed amiably. "A fine name, isn't it so, Captain? What to do? I can't even remember what name I used to have from before. The name my mother father gave me. Pretty stupid, eh, Captain?"
But Picture Singh was not stupid, and there was much more to him than charm. Suddenly his voice lost its casual, sleepy good nature. He whispered,
Now, Captain, ick dum, double quick time.
Poverty whipped lid away from wicker. I dived headfirst into her cryptic basket. The lid, returning, blocked out the day's last light. Picture Singh whispered,
Okay, Captain, damn good.
And Poverty bent down close to me. Her lips must have been against the outside of the basket. What Poverty the Witch whispered through wickerwork.
Hey, you, Salim, just to think. You and me, mister. Midnight's children, yeah? That's something, no?
That's something. Salim, shrouded in wickerwork darkness, was reminded of years ago midnights, of childhood wrestling bouts with purpose and meaning. Overwhelmed by nostalgia, I still did not understand what that something was. Then, Poverty whispered some other words, and inside the basket of invisibility, I, Salim Sanai, complete with my loose, anonymous garment, vanished, instantly, into thin air.
Vanished? How vanished? What vanished?
Padma's head jerks up. Padma's eyes stare at me in bewilderment. I, shrugging, merely reiterate. Vanished. Just like that. Disappeared. Dematerialized. Like a djinn. Poof. Like so.
So? Padma presses me. She really truly was a witch?
Really truly. I was in the basket, but also not in the basket. Picture Singh lifted it one-handed and tossed it into the back of the army truck, taking him and Poverty and 99 others to the aircraft waiting at the military airfield. I was tossed with the basket, but also not tossed. Afterwards, Picture Singh said,
"No, Captain, I could not feel your weight."
Nor could I feel any bump, thump, bang. 101 artists arrived by IAF troop transport from the capital of India. 102 persons returned, although one of them was both there and not there. Yes, magic spells can occasionally succeed, but also fail. My father, Amit Sanai, never succeeded in cursing Sherry, the mongrel bitch. Without passport or permit, I returned, cloaked in invisibility, to the land of my birth. Believe, don't believe, but even a skeptic will have to provide another explanation for my presence here. Did not the Caliph Harun al-Rashid, in an earlier set of fabulous tales, also wander, unseen, invisible, anonymous, cloaked through the streets of Baghdad? what Harun achieved in Baghdad streets, Parvati the Witch made possible for me, as we flew through the air lanes of the subcontinent. She did it. I was invisible. Thus, enough. Memories of Invisibility. In the basket I learned what it was like, will be like, to be dead. I had acquired the characteristics of ghosts. Present but insubstantial, actual but without being or weight. I discovered in the basket how ghosts see the world. Dimly, hazily, faintly. It was around me, but only just. I hung in a sphere of absence at whose fringes, like faint reflections, could be seen the spectres of wickerwork. The dead die and are gradually forgotten. Time does its healing, and they fade. But in Parvati's basket, I learned that the reverse is also true, that ghosts too begin to forget, that the dead lose their memories of the living, and at last, when they are detached from their lives, fade away. That dying, in short, continues for a long time after death. Afterwards, Parvati said, I didn't want to tell you, but nobody should be kept invisible that long. It was dangerous, but what else was there to do? In the grip of Parvati's sorcery, I felt my hold on the world slip away, and how easy, how peaceful not to never to return, to float in this cloudy nowhere, wafting further, 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 like a seed spore blown on the breeze. In short, I was in mortal danger. What I held on to in that ghostly time and space, a silver spittoon, which transformed like myself by Parvati-whispered words, was nevertheless a reminder of the outside. Clutching finely wrought silver, which glittered even in that nameless dark, I survived. Despite head-to-toe numbness, I was saved, perhaps, by the glints of my precious souvenir. No, there was more to it than spittoons, for, as we all know by now, our hero is greatly affected by being shut up in confined spaces. Transformations spring upon him in the enclosed dark. As a mere embryo in the secrecy of a womb, not his mother's, did he not grow into the incarnation of the new myth of August 15th, the child of TikTok? Did he not emerge as the Mubarak, the blessed child? In a cramped washroom, were name tags not switched around? Alone in a washing chest with a drawstring up one nostril, did he not glimpse a black mango and sniff too hard, turning himself and his upper cucumber into a kind of supernatural ham radio? Hemmed in by doctors, nurses, and anesthetic masks, did he not succumb to numbers and, having suffered drainage above, move into a second phase, that of nasal philosopher and, later, tracker supreme? Squashed in a small abandoned hut beneath the body of Ayuba Balok, did he not learn the meaning of fair and unfair? Well then, trapped in the occult peril of the basket of invisibility, I was saved not only by the glints of a spittoon, but also by another transformation, in the grip of that awful disembodied loneliness, whose smell was the smell of graveyards, I discovered anger. Something was fading in Salim, and something was being born. Fading. An old pride in baby snaps and framed Nehru letter. An old determination to espouse, willingly, a prophesied historical role. And also a willingness to make allowances to understand how parents and strangers might legitimately despise or exile him for his ugliness. Mutilated fingers and monk's tonsures no longer seemed like good enough excuses for the way in which I had been treated. The object of my wrath was, in fact, everything which I had, until then, blindly accepted. My parents' desire that I should repay their investment in me by becoming great, genius like a shawl. The modes of connection themselves inspired in me a blind, lunging fury. Why me? Why, owing to accidents of birth, prophecy, etc., must I be responsible for language riots, and after Nehru who? For pepper pot revolutions and bombs which annihilated my family? Why should I, Salim, Snotnose, Stiffer, Mapface, Piece of the Moon, accept the blame for what was not done by Pakistani troops in Dhaka? Why, alone of all the more than 500 million, should I have to bear the burden of history? What my discovery of unfairness, smelling of onions, had begun, my invisible rage completed. Wrath enabled me to survive the soft siren temptations of invisibility. Anger made me determined, after I was released from banishment in the shadow of a Friday mosque, to begin from that moment forth to choose my own undestined future. And there, in the silence of graveyard-reeking isolation, I heard the long-ago voice of the virginal Mary Pereira singing, "Anything you want to be, you can be. You can be just what all you want." Tonight, as I recall my rage, I remain perfectly calm. The widow drained anger out of me along with everything else. Remembering my basket-born rebellion against inevitability, I even permit myself a wry, understanding smile. "Boys," I mutter tolerantly across the years to Salim at 24, "will be boys." In the widow's hostel, I was taught harshly, once and for all, the lesson of no escape. Now, seated hunched over paper in a pool of angle-poised light, I no longer want to be anything except what, who I am. Who, what am I? My answer. I am the sum total of everything that went before me, of all I have been seen done, of everything done to me. I am everyone, everything whose being in the world affected was affected by mine. I am anything that happens after I've gone, which would not have happened if I had not come. Nor am I particularly exceptional in this matter. Each I, every one of the now 600 million plus of us, contains a similar multitude. I repeat for the last time. To understand me, you'll have to swallow a world. Although now, as the pouring out of what was inside me nears an end, as cracks widen within, I can hear and feel the rip-tear crunch. I begin to grow thinner, translucent almost. There isn't much of me left, and soon there will be nothing at all. 600 million specks of dust, and all transparent, invisible as glass. But then I was angry. Glandular hyperactivity in a wicker amphora, eccrine and apocrine glands poured forth sweat and stink, as if I were trying to shed my fate through my pores. And, in fairness to my wrath, I must record that it claimed one instant achievement, that when I tumbled out of the basket of invisibility into the shadow of the mosque, I had been rescued by rebellion from the abstraction of numbness, as I bumped out onto the dirt of the magician's ghetto, silver spittoon in hand, I realized that I had begun once again to feel. Some afflictions, at least, are capable of being conquered. The Shadow of the Mosque. No shadow of a doubt. An acceleration is taking place. Rip, crunch, crack. While road surfaces split in the awesome heat, I too am being hurried towards disintegration. What gnaws on bones, which, as I have been regularly obliged to explain to the too many women around me, is far beyond the powers of medicine men to discern, much less to cure, will not be denied for long, and still so much remains to be told. Uncle Mustafa is growing inside me, and the pout of poverty the witch. A certain lock of hero's hair is waiting in the wings, and also a labour of 13 days and a history as an analogue of a prime minister's hairstyle. There is to be treason, and fair dodging, and the scent, wafting on breezes heavy with the ululations of widows, of something frying in an iron skillet, so that I, too, am forced to accelerate, to make a wild dash for the finishing line. Before memory cracks beyond hope of reassembly, I must breast the tape. Although already there are fadings and gaps, it will be necessary to improvise on occasion. 26 pickle jars stand gravely on a shelf, 26 special blends, each with its identifying label, neatly inscribed with familiar phrases, movements performed by pepper pots, for instance, or Alpha and Omega, or Commander Sabramati's baton. 26 rattle eloquently when local trains go yellow and browning past. On my desk, 5 empty jars tinkle urgently, reminding me of my uncompleted task. But now I cannot linger over empty pickle jars. The night is for words, and green chutney must wait its turn. Padma is wistful. Oh, mister, how lovely Kashmir must be in August, when here it is hot like a chili. I am obliged to reprove my plump yet muscled companion, whose attention has been wandering, and to observe that our Padma Bibi, long-suffering, tolerant, consoling, is beginning to behave exactly like a traditional Indian wife, and I, with my distances and self-absorption, like a husband? Of late, in spite of my stoic fatalism about the spreading cracks, I have smelled on Padma's breath the dream of an alternative but impossible future. Ignoring the implacable finalities of inner fissures, she has begun to exude the bitter-sweet fragrance of hope for marriage. My dung lotus, who remained impervious for so long to the sneer-lipped barbs hurled by our workforce of downy four-armed women, who placed her cohabitation with me outside and above all codes of social propriety, has seemingly succumbed to a desire for legitimacy. In short, although she has not said a word on the subject, she is waiting for me to make an honest woman of her. The perfume of her sad hopefulness permeates her most innocently solicitous remarks. Even at this very moment, as she, "Hey, mister, why not finish your writery and then take rest? Go to Kashmir, sit quietly for some time, and maybe you will take your Padma also, and she can look after..." Behind this burgeoning dream of a Kashmiri holiday, which was once also the dream of Jehangir, the Mughal emperor, of poor forgotten Ilsa Lubin, and perhaps of Christ himself, I nose out the presence of another dream. But neither this nor that can be fulfilled, because now the cracks, and always the cracks, are narrowing my future towards its single inescapable full point, and even Padma must take a back seat if I'm to finish my tales. Today the papers are talking about the supposed political rebirth of Mrs. Indira Gandhi. But when I returned to India, concealed in a wicker basket, the Madame was basking in the fullness of her glory. Today, perhaps, we are already forgetting, sinking willingly into the insidious clouds of amnesia. But I remember, and will set down how it happened that... No, I can't say it. I must tell it in the proper order until there is no option but to reveal. On December 16th, 1971, I tumbled out of a basket into an India in which Mrs. Gandhi's new Congress party held a more than two-thirds majority in the National Assembly. In the basket of invisibility, a sense of unfairness turned into anger, and something else besides. Transformed by rage, I had also been overwhelmed by an agonizing feeling of sympathy for the country which was not only my twin in birth, but also joined to me, so to speak, at the hip, so that what happened to either of us happened to us both. If I, snot-nosed, stain-faced, etc., had a hard time of it, then so had she, my subcontinental twin sister. And now that I had given myself the right to choose a better future, I was resolved that the nation should share it too. I think that when I tumbled out into dust, shadow, and amused cheers, I had already decided to save the country. But there are cracks and gaps. Had I by then begun to see that my love for Jamila Singer had been, in a sense, a mistake? Had I already understood how I had simply transferred onto her shoulders the adoration which I now perceived to be a vaulting, all-encompassing love of country? When was it that I realized that my truly incestuous feelings were for my true birth sister, India herself, and not for that trollop of a crooner who had so callously shed me like a used snakeskin and dropped me into the metaphorical wastebasket of army life? When? Admitting defeat, I am forced to record that I cannot remember for sure. Salim sat blinking in the dust in the shadow of the mosque. A giant was standing over him, grinning hugely, asking, "Acha, Captain, have a good trip?" And Parvati, with huge excited eyes, pouring water from a lota into his cracked, salty mouth. Feeling. The icy touch of water kept cool in earthenware surahis. The cracked soreness of parched raw lips, silver and lapis clenched in a fist. "I can feel," Salim cried to the good-natured crowd. It was the time of the afternoon called the Chaya, when the shadow of the tall red brick and marble Friday mosque fell across the higgledy shacks of the slum clustered at its feet. That slum, whose ramshackle tin roofs created such a swelter of heat that it was insupportable to be inside the fragile shacks except during the Chaya and at night. But now, conjurers and contortionists and jugglers and fakirs had gathered in the shade around the solitary standpipe to greet the new arrival. "I can feel," I cried, and then picture saying,
"Okay, Captain, tell us how it feels to be born again, falling like baby out of poverty's basket."
I could smell amazement on Picture Singh. He was clearly astounded by Parvati's trick, but, like a true professional, would not dream of asking her how she had achieved it. In this way, Parvati the witch, who had used her limitless power to spirit me to safety, escaped discovery, and also because, as I later discovered, the ghetto of the magicians disbelieved, with the absolute certainty of illusionists by trade, in the possibility of magic. So, Picture Singh told me with amazement,
"I swear, Captain, you were so light in there, like a baby."
But he never dreamt that my weightlessness had been anything more than a trick.
"Listen, baby sahab," Picture Singh was crying. "What do you say, baby Captain? Must I put you over my shoulder and make you belch?"
And now Parvati, tolerantly,
"That one, Baba, always making jokeshok."
She was smiling radiantly at everyone in sight, but there followed an inauspicious event. A woman's voice began to wail at the back of the cluster of magicians.
Ay-oh, ay-oh, ay-oh.
The crowd parted in surprise, and an old woman burst through it and rushed at Salim. I was required to defend myself against a brandished frying pan until Picture Singh, alarmed, seized her by pan-waving arm and bellowed,
"Hey, Captina, why so much noise?"
And the old woman obstinately,
"Resham Bibi," Parvati said crossly, "you got ants in your brain?"
And Picture Singh,
"We got a guest, Captina. What'll he do with your shouting? Aray, be quiet, Resham. This captain is known to our Parvati personal. Don't be coming crying in front of him."
Ay-oh, bad luck is come. You go to foreign places and